Glad to be here with you. It's always glad to see old friends. I'm from the Detroit area, but moved out in 1981 after 2 years at Tyndale that Randy just described. And it is true, we were in a carpool together. Man, we had really small cars. I had a Chevy Chevette, if you could imagine that. And we got five college guys in that car. Five. And we'd have to leave. You know how that goes. You'd leave like 2 hours before class to run around and pick everybody up. So,
yeah, and everybody had to be sure to use their deodorant when we were in that carpool together.
Yeah, a lot of fun. Oh, yeah. Then what do we do coming home after classes? What do we often do?
Oh, we always got some frozen custard. Yes.
Frozen custard.
Yes.
That was here.
All right, who will be first? Just shoot your hands up if you have a question. Chris, why don't you field the first one? I got some over here.
Good morning, Dr. Habermas. I had a question regarding what caused you to start investigating Jesus' resurrection. Was there an event in your life or something of that nature, or just curiosity?
You know what? I'm asked that a lot, and I'm not sure. I do a lot of radio interviews and media interviews, and that question comes a lot, and people assume I'm like super altruistic or something. Did you do that because you wanted to help people with their doubts? No, I wanted to help me with my doubts. I went through about, Randy, I mean, the guys in the carpool probably had no idea, because I was able to teach Orthodox Christianity, but at the same time, I was going through some real tough struggles with my own questions. And so I actually did it because when I started doubting, I grew up at Redeemer Baptist, so German Baptist, I'm German, and I became a Christian pretty young, but the doubt started rolling in, and people are telling me in those days, don't study apologetics, all you need is faith, all you need is faith. And, well, I'm not like that. And so here's why I started studying it. They told me a bunch of subjects I could study, and I didn't think most of the subjects were like interesting but couldn't answer all my questions. But I realized right away the resurrection would fit the bill and in one way or another answer every question if it were true. So that started me on a lifelong study of the resurrection for my own doubts. Now, if the Lord uses it later for ministry, killing two birds with one stone, that's fantastic. But for me, it was hockey and football in the afternoons, come in at night, ignore my homework because I hated it anyway, and the first question was, where did I leave off of my doubts last night? So.
Well, who'll be next? Aha, question right here.
Dr. Habermas, what do you say to someone who says, Jesus is God is a legend that grew over time?
Okay, who says Jesus is a legend?
Yes.
So he never lived?
Jesus is God.
Jesus as God.
As God.
His death? I'm not. Folks, I'll just tell you right off the bat, I've lost 75% of my hearing, so I'm going to let your pastor interpret for me.
I guess we'd be focusing on the deity of Jesus. That's a legend?
Yes. Is the deity of Jesus legend?
Deity only is it a legend.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, when I do resurrection, I do what I call a minimal facts argument. Now, let me explain minimal facts real fast because it'll be the basis for most questions. When I go to a secular campus, I'll say, if when I hold this up, people will know, they'll go, wow, you have a first edition. It is. It's a first edition to the NIV. And I'll hold it up and I'll say, if this book is inspired, Jesus has been raised from the dead. Is that fair? Even if you're a skeptic, if it's inspired, Jesus has been raised. Fair? Because what's in it's true. All right. What if it's not inspired? What if it's unreliable? It's just what the skeptics say, i.e., not much. Is Jesus still raised from the dead on this Bible? On the skeptic's Bible, has Jesus been raised from the dead? What do you think? Yes, is the answer. You go, how in the world can you get Jesus on a Bible that's shot full of holes with, let's say, it's, you know, 10% of Homer might be true. Maybe 10% of the Bible's true. Well, here's why. Because the facts that critics admit are the ones that are best attested. And the best attested facts are enough to show that Jesus is raised from the dead. So on, here's how I often do the argument. Heads, we win. Tails, they lose. Because Jesus was raised on either view. Now, you say, what about deity? Deity's the same question. I would do a minimal facts deity argument, and would go like this. I will use only the texts which critics admit. Well, how do you know only what critics admit? Because they all admit the same body of data, and I've studied it all my life. I can think like a liberal easier than I can think as an evangelical, because that's what I do my whole life. I use this illustration. I've asked a few biologists. Nobody's told me if it's true or not, but it's a good picture. I'll say, why don't spiders get caught in their own webs? And I don't know if this is true, but I've been told they know which strands to run across and which ones would catch them if they stepped on the wrong ones, but they know the difference. Okay, that's a really important analogy, because if you only run across the New Testament on the critics' passages that they will let you use, you can still get the deity of Christ. So what will you use? Let me give you my chief argument for the deity of Christ. In the New Testament, there are what are called, they're almost synonyms, but not quite, what are called creeds, confessions, traditions, they go by different words, and they are in the New Testament for the first time. As far as we know, they're written for the first time. But they existed, they predated the New Testament by many years. Bart Ehrman, a New Testament atheist, he's a New Testament specialist, but he's an atheist. He thinks that the vast majority of these creeds, you got to be ready for this, the vast majority of these creeds about the New Testament, they predate Paul's conversion, and they come from the apostolic era in Jerusalem. Bart Ehrman admits it freely. Now here, let me just sort of do it this way. Paul's walking toward Damascus. He sees this experience, and he's converted right here. Critics put that at 1 to 2 years after the cross. These creedal passages were already in existence, and they were birthed back here. So they're extremely early, come from extremely good testimony, are probably apostolic in nature, coming from Jerusalem. They're extremely evidential. And guess what? About 80% of the creedal verses are spin around the topic of the gospel. What's the gospel? The deity, death, resurrection of Jesus is God's side of the content. The question is, do you want to say I do to Jesus? That's what these creeds are about. And they're early, they're eyewitness, from Jerusalem, authoritative, historical, and they proclaim the death of Jesus. One example, Romans chapter 10, verse 9, what they call a baptismal creed. And it's one of the best known two or three verses of the New Testament, right? If you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God's raised him from the dead, you'll be saved. He's called Lord. 3 verses later, Paul says, with our mouths we confess. And he says, whoever calls the name of the Lord will be saved. He's quoting from the Old Testament. And the verse there is Jehovah. Adonai, the Greek, in the New Testament, is how Jehovah-type words are used, how they're transliterated, changed over to the New Testament Greek language. And that was there before Paul was converted? Yep. The earliest church believed he was Jehovah before Paul was converted? Yep. That's what's called early high Christology. And that's just a starting place. I would use others. But using only their data, we have enough to show that Jesus was believed to be God and that he claimed that about himself. Sorry for that long explanation, but this creed thing, It's going to come up on almost everything you ask, because it's the foundation of good apologetics today are these early creedal statements.
All right, Andy? Yeah, just a follow-up to what you just talked about. What facts about the resurrection would most critics agree with?
Okay, I got that one first time, believe it or not. What facts about the resurrection would Christians readily agree to? Well, I'll tell you what. I will cite an actual debate I had with one of the top New Testament scholars in the world. He's an agnostic. His name is James Crossley. He's very well known in the data. Not a Christian. He'll tell you, I'm not a Christian. And he and I dialogued in person in London on Justin Briley's program, Unbelievable. And the topic for discussion was, do the minimal facts support belief in the resurrection of Jesus? And Justin said, all right, let's get going with this. Gary, what facts are you going to use? I said, I'll use these six. Jesus died by crucifixion. Afterwards, the disciples had experiences. Now watch my language. Like nobody, scholars now, only scholars. Not the guys that blog in their parents' basement while they still live with their parents. They claim to be New Testament scholars and they're 15 years old. It's like, yeah, right. Scholars. They all accept this comment. I'm wording it very carefully. The disciples had experiences that they believe were appearances of the risen Jesus. Yes. Bart Ehrman believes that? The atheist New Testament scholar? Absolutely. He says the New Testament is based on this fact. Okay. Died. They had experiences which they said were appearances of Jesus. They were reported very early. What's very early? Well, what I just said. That before Paul's even converted, many of these things are already in existence. And critics accept that. Bart Ehrman says there are many early statements about the deity of Christ, death, resurrection, while Paul in circulation, while Paul was an unbeliever. That's pretty tough. Okay, very early. Four, they turned the world upside down. Now, I don't claim they all died for their faith. You can't prove that. But I think they were willing to die for your faith. And if you want to follow up on that, be glad to answer it. They're willing to die. And then two individuals who are enough distinct that I list them as five and six, James and Paul, become Christians. They were unbelievers until they met the risen Jesus. So, death, experiences that they believe were Jesus' resurrection, appearances, very, very early, transformation, James and Paul. And Justin Briley turned to James Crossley, and he said, James, what do you think about these six? And James, you can hear it online. James goes just like this. He can have them. I have nothing to say against them. Those six facts. You don't? No, nothing. He said, can I say one more thing? And the moderator said, sure. He said, the six facts Gary chose are the six best attested facts of the New Testament. He said, yeah, go ahead. So later in the broadcast, we dialogued for 2 hours, the host asked James Crossley, James, if the data are this good, why don't you believe? And James said, I'm just not into belief. I'm just not into belief questions. Here's the short answer. I don't want to. And that's his right. That's his right. But it's not the data are bad. That's just not where he is in life. So those are the six I'd use.
Cool. Question over here. I see Jen had a hand.
Thank you. Dr. Habermas, my question is, in the first service, you talked about near-death experiences with people feeling comforted, that they were lifelong remembrances, you know, and things that comforted them. What about experiences that are not comforting? Are there people who have frightening experiences, experiences that make them turn toward Christ because of what they saw?
I am lost. I heard about 1 in 5 words. I'm sorry.
Okay. Hey, Doc, let me ask you just to stand more in the center so you're in the spotlight there so we can see you for the live streaming. She asked about, she said there are comforting near-death experiences. What about near-death experiences that are not comforting? Somebody else asked me this between the services. Are there any experiences where the person says, I went to hell?
21% of NDEs are hell experiences. Now, there's different kinds of hells in these experiences. could be fire, could be blackness with despair and depression and anxiety. One really key case, this guy was a university professor, atheist. His wife was an atheist lawyer, and he had a zombie experience. He said these demons were, he's an unbeliever, he's an atheist, and he says these demons were chasing him, trying to bite off and tear off pieces of flesh, extremely painful. He became a Christian in the experience. He calls on Jesus in the NDE, and he says, Jesus! And he sees this little tiny pinpoint light out there, and there's a right in front of him. Jesus. Whoa. What's going on? And for the next whatever minutes, who knows, he asked all his heavy atheist questions, and he said Jesus answered him. And anyway, that was one of the key ones. And the guy, when he got back from his experience, left the field he was teaching at Northern Kentucky University, went to seminary, and as far as I know, is today still a pastor. So his life was transformed. Yeah, 21%.
Mary?
Okay, along the similar, can you hear me? I was questioned based on the near-death experience that you shared with us at the earlier service. I was always under the impression that people or spirits in heaven couldn't or wouldn't be able to see what was going on earth. But you shared that one Twilight story of that deceased man who told the person who had the near-death experience that his cousin was killed in Afghanistan, which would indicate otherwise, that the man who'd been in heaven for a while could see what was happening on earth. So my question is, do people in heaven see what's happening on earth?
I have no idea because I can't hear your question. I'm sorry. this happens all the time with me.
Do people in heaven see what's happening here on earth?
Were there two parts of this? Is it just part one?
Based on following up from the experience about the guy in Afghanistan who had died. Yeah.
You know what? I don't think anybody can answer that question. We just don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if it was sometimes yes, sometimes no. Or sometimes the knowledge is made known to them, the Afghanistan story. Yeah, sometimes they come to, but why? Did they watch it happen? Or were they told? Or was it implanted in their brain and they knew it? I have no idea. But you asked the question, can they watch us? And one thing I will say, the verse in, what is it, Randy? Hebrews 12:1?
Hebrews 12:1,
we're surrounded with a cloud of witnesses, right?
Right, right.
A lot of people use that to say they're watching us. And that's almost for sure not what that verse means, because it ends after 11, and the cloud of witnesses are all these heroes of faith in chapter 11. So I don't think that's a good verse for it. I don't think we know the answer to the question. We just have to, and when they say things and they're right, like he's going to be killed, we don't know how they came to know it. But obviously they came to know it. I just don't know how.
I've got a question over here. This one actually comes from our Facebook Live feed right now, and it's on the same line. So it's, how do we know that near-death experiences are from God or Satan? And is there biblical evidence to support that answer?
Let me take the second one first. Yes, there are biblical cases. And it seems like there are near-death or near-death-like experiences in the New Testament. And some examples. Now this one, Lazarus, not the Lazarus that Jesus raised from the dead, but the rich man Lazarus, which I believe was a parable, but that's immaterial. He says the Lazarus died and went to Abraham's bosom. The rich man died too, and he went to Hades or the equivalent at that time. And they don't come back to talk, but Jesus narrates the experience. And it says he died and he was carried by angels to Abraham's bosom. That's exactly the order of events for many, not all, but for many of the NDEs. You know the old chick tracks where the angels got the arm around the person's waist and they're like Supermaning through the heavens? That's where they get that from, that verse in Luke 16. And it seems like it's describing, the guy doesn't come back, but that's Jesus telling us what happened. That's one idea. Another one, Stephen is stoned in Acts 7. And just before he dies, before they start throwing the stones, he looks up and sees Jesus on the right hand of God. That is some kind of near-death-like experience if he's seen Jesus beforehand. And maybe the best example is 2 Corinthians 12, where Paul says, I know a man 12 years ago who, whether in or out of the body, he says twice, whether out of the body or in the body, I know not which. He was caught up to the third heaven. Well, he talks about him in third person. I know a man. But then he goes on and tells you it's him. And the interesting thing is, when you look at old little commentaries, I mean little commentaries like Unger, I think it's Unger, Ryrie's Study Notes, and Unger's little Bible handbook. I think I'm pretty sure they both say, this is before the NDEs were a big deal. Before, they couldn't have gotten the idea for this comet from the NDEs. In fact, Ryrie, he didn't even like the NDE data. I talked to him about it when he was alive. He wasn't even crazy about it. But in their little studies, they both said, this sounds like the kind of experience that people have today when they come close to death. So they wrote that right there. I think probably this is the best one is 2 Corinthians 12. We also have them in Plato. They're back B.C., hundreds of years B.C., they're in the literature. So now, was that the, remind me, was that the second one? Or was there just one there? Just one? Okay.
Yes, sir. What is the, in modern times, what is the first recorded near-death experience?
In modern times, you mean like 20th century?
Right.
I don't know what the first one would be because it kind of burst on the scene about 1975 when Raymond Moody wrote his book, Life After Life, and he's got about 110 of them in that book. So that was just about the first to be written on, and they all kind of came together. I'm not sure anybody knows what the first reported one. By the way, if you look down, there are all kinds of books in the 18th century, 17th century, where these experiences, so they way predate the 20th century.
All right, this kind of a two-part question. First of all, if NDEs are common across cultures, Eastern cultures, Native cultures, and if they present differently in those cultures than they do in a Western setting.
Okay, are they cross-cultural and what?
And do they present differently than they do in a Western culture?
I'm not hearing the second part.
If people from other cultures, do they experience near-death experiences in different ways according to their own traditions?
Well, if you even had 20 American ones, it would be a little bit different. If you had 10 American and 10 Indian ones, they'd be a little bit different. But they're roughly the same. One, there's many cross-cultural studies. One of the earliest ones was 1961, I think was the date. And it was of 600 Hindus, or almost all Hindus, but 600 Indians from India. And they have all kinds of, a higher percentage of theirs were negative than the 21% of American and Canadian, Western European studies, be that as it may. But yeah, they're pretty much the same. There have been studies of Chinese. There's been studies of almost any culture. I'm an editor of a journal of near-death studies, which is the only peer-reviewed near-death journal. And every once in a while, you see another article in another culture, and they give reports on all of them. There's not that much difference to even, make the point of any significance.
Hi, thanks for coming. My question is regarding free will. If God is omniscient and has pre-knowledge of every action in my life, do I have free will to act in the world, or is my actions determined by God's foreknowledge?
Okay. And of course, this is my view, right? First of all, a lot of people misunderstand this. If God knows something will happen, it will happen no matter what. You go, well, that sounds to me like I'm not free. No, that does not follow. Because the old comeback is either in what's called simple foreknowledge or something like Molinism, which is a much more sophisticated view of foreknowledge, and any of those foreknowledge type views, the comeback would be, well, if God knows you're going to trust Christ on August 23rd, 1993, you will trust Christ on August 23rd, 1993. You will know that. You go, well, then I'm not free. No, you are free. And if you decided not to accept Christ on that date, and you accepted on December 25th, 2014, then only his knowledge of the event would have been different from before time, because he could know. Now, once he locks your decision in, it's locked in. You can't go, no, I like the first date, 93. No, too late. You've made your decision. If he knows it, it's locked in. But the point is, it was only locked in because you freely made the decision. That's the other side. And that's the side I hold. I hold one of the foreknowledge views. I mean, it's going to happen. It's determined. But the question is, why is it determined?
What would you say is the atheist's most compelling argument, and then how would you answer that?
Most compelling argument about what?
Against Christianity. Against Christianity.
Oh, okay. Anything in particular? Against NDEs, against the resurrection, against the deity of Christ? What do you have in mind?
No, I'm trying to remember. I had a conversation with a lady, and kind of tying into what the previous person just said, that, the passages that talk about how God has placed people, he has determined the time and the place and all of that, and then she really struggled with people that are extremely impoverished or in these areas of the world that have never heard of Jesus, and, why would he knowingly place somebody in a position where he sure knew they were going to be raped? Say that.
And whether it's their view or our view, that much is indeterminate. I mean, if God knows it, it will occur, right? In general, here's how I answer these kind of questions in general. Can an atheist take Christianity down with almost any objection? And I'd say, first of all, most objections that they give are periphery objections, rarely periphery. Most Christians don't realize they're periphery, so they get all worried when they can't answer it. And a knowledgeable apologist will say, I don't give a rip how you answer it, because it's not relevant to the gospel. So Mike Lacone and I, a good friend of mine, a New Testament scholar, we've begun to get our point across. We've begun answering questions like this. We go to State University. We want people to think. And they go to State University, and they'll go, what about the Old Testament genocide? That might be the toughest question of all, Old Testament genocide. Okay, they might say, hey, hotshot, how did Jesus, and they're atheists, right? How did Judas kill himself? Sounds like a contradiction to me. All right, I can tell you, we love contradiction questions because they're the most kind of critique there is. If you read the literature for the last 200 years, atheist and higher critical literature, they think they've got you when they prove a contradiction. It's like just a stupid objection, frankly, because they admit, they, like any ancient historian, is going to have things you can't put together. And they still accept all the historicity from them. How do they do it? Because they have enough data to accept facts at a certain time. So Mike and I answer the question like this. Someone goes, what about Judas? How did he commit suicide? And I would do this. In the universe, I go, and? How do you answer it? And? That's how I answer it. No, how? You must be misunderstanding. No, I'm not misunderstanding you. What difference does that make? Well, if you can't answer this and there's a problem, then there's an error in the Bible and blah, blah, blah. And? Not sure where you're going here. Okay, here's my point. If all I have are the six minimum, that I can get the deity, death, and resurrection of Jesus so that I can be on the yellow brick road marching toward the Emerald City, or Pilgrim's Progress if you want, or, whatever analogy you want to use. If I could do it with six facts, and you allow, as an atheist, I'm not saying you are, but I mean the questioner, if they allow all six facts, and I can get the whole way, hey, I'll tell you what, on genocide, thanks for that question. I'm going to ask Joshua in heaven. I'm going to ask Moses in heaven. What about Judas? I'm going to ask Jesus how it went down. I think that's a great question. But here's my point. See, we're kind of playing with them a little bit. Because I hold the Bible as inerrant. I think that. But I'm trying to get them to realize I don't care how many errors you think there are. If you can't blow this case for these six, you've lost. Because if we have the center of Christianity, you can pick like Swiss cheese around the edges, and I'm still on the road. There's still a heaven. There's still an immortal city. You are barking up the wrong tree. And my friend, and then I would add the zinger, I'm real concerned about you, because if that's there and you're not there. So that's how we answer those questions. A lot of times I'll say to them, by the way, that's not hard. It's this, 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 and this. This, 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 and this. Okay, this, 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 and this. But a lot of times we do this and, because we want them to see their question is of no eternal consequence. Well, you didn't answer my question. And? If you can't get me off this trail to heaven, I'm there, you're not. That's a very important question. That's just such a question for us. So that's how we go after that a lot of times.
How about right here?
What's your explanation for non-Christians who have near-death experiences and come back no longer afraid of death but see no need for faith in Jesus?
All right, I heard about half of that. What about non-Christians who have near-death experiences and they what?
Come back no longer afraid of death, but also...
No longer afraid of death because the angel or whomever said, you're going to be coming back here in a few years and you're going to be just fine.
But they also don't see the need for faith in Jesus.
I didn't hear the end.
They don't see a need for faith in Christ.
Ah, now, I knew I told a couple of guys after the service, I know I'm going to get that question. That is probably the best question on this data. And let me give you an answer that answers all those questions. There are two kinds of NDE data that we've been discussing, evidential and non-evidential. Evidential ones, if you think about it, 98% of the evidential ones are this worldly. Saw a car accident out there. Saw my chain smoking. I saw my grandmother, who's never smoked a day in her life. I saw her smoking, if you heard my examples. That machine in my room was not plugged in. I saw the plug on the ground. It's this worldly stuff. Okay. And it's evidenced. But it's this worldly. Whenever they give the otherworldly stuff, it's not evidenced. How do I know you saw an angel? I'm just telling you. Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know you saw an angel. I can hear your testimony, but I don't know that. Well, this knife cuts both ways, you know. What if a Christian said they said, same rule. If there's no data, I can hear you. I can say, yeah, maybe, I don't know. That sounds kind of captivating. But without evidence, and all of those, the angel told me I'm coming back. I'm going to be okay. I'm a Buddhist, but I'm going to heaven. They told me. How do you know that? They told me. How am I supposed to know that? So I'm telling you, hey, no offense. You were in a really bad way. You were really close to death. You were out. I don't have any way of knowing your testimony is true. And again, the comeback is, well, would you say it to Christians? Yes, I would. Okay, well, now let's get a real tough one. Would you say that about the hell cases? Or are you cool with the hell cases? It supports your worldview. I say it about the hell cases too. We don't know if any of the existential ones for which there's no data, we don't know. You know, if someone's in a car accident and they try to explain what happened, but we know they were out for most of the time, you go, and you take everything they say with a severe grain of salt. That's how I treat those. So if someone says, angel said I'm coming back, I will go right away to evidences. I'll say, what do you do with the resurrection? Well, it doesn't make a difference because I'm coming back. Yeah, but you don't have any evidence for your view. I have evidence for what I'm doing. So mine trumps yours. What are you going to do with this? So I'll try to get him back in the path and back to salvation. But I don't have to object to, I don't have to answer anybody's question, including Christians, including the hell ones. They're all in the same case. Unevidenced, they're simply a story they're telling when they were really messed up in the head. They were in a bad way. Car accident, cancer. I heard one a little bit earlier, a brain cancer case. Well, it's really hard to know exactly what is reality and what isn't. So, and yeah, I would treat the Christian ones the same way I would treat the non-Christian ones. Can't be sure. So when they say, I'm going to come back in a few years, I'll say, that's your view. You can't tell me how it's true. Well, I'm just telling you what I saw. No, you're telling me what you think you saw. Sorry, I don't have any data for that. Well, you wouldn't say it to a Christian. Yes, I would.
We have time for maybe one more question.
Okay, in the near-death experiences, when, you know, people talk about things, even there's evidence they were out of the room, they were in the room, they saw things. Their physical brain was dead. It was flatlined, right? How would you describe the difference between the physical brain and the spiritual mind that is thinking when the brain is dead?
Okay. Now, again, I heard most of that one. What's the mind doing when the body is measurably dead?
Yes, like the brain is dead. The EEG says it's flatline. But during that time, they're outside of their body spiritually, but their mind is still working.
Correct. And you know what's interesting? Yeah, that's an argument for what philosophers would call philosophical dualism. And whenever you hear, like the Indian fellow I told you about who fell out of the tree and fell 25 feet and hit the ground, I said, so, where were you? Were you up in the air or were you down on the ground? He goes, here's what they all say. I was up in the air. Well, I thought that's your body. Yeah, I know, but I'm up here. How do you know you're up here? Because we always date our location. Date's not the right word. We always judge our location by our consciousness, by our point of consciousness. This is me up here looking down. That body, I can't make it move by moving my, I can't make it move. I mean, that was the body I was in, but this is my immaterial portion. And they go away, sure, the immaterial portion. That's called dualism. Naturalists hate it. Bertrand Russell, many people have said over the years, naturalism, the view that the natural world is all there is, has two signature beliefs. There's no God and there's no afterlife. When you're talking afterlife, you're talking something very dear to their heart. They don't want the afterlife to be true because they've lost one of their pillars. They also don't want you to have a good argument for God. You got both of them. They are in bad, bad shape. And now you come to them and say, if you know them real well, you go, Bob, listen, you and I have been friends for a long time, but I just want to tell you something. I hate to say this because I'm not triumphing in it, but I have data you don't. Your worldview is wrong. And let me just be frank. I am worried about your soul. I worry about what you're going. You may not want to believe, and that's your choice, but I'm thinking you better go where the evidence leads, and it sounds to me you're not even willing to do that. Recently, friends have told me that several of their atheist buddies, they've said to the atheist buddies, would you believe if you couldn't do anything with the data? If you couldn't disprove the data, would you believe? And I just heard several key examples from very well-known atheists. And they said, no. So the evidence is good. I can see that. Would you believe? I'll just ask you again. Would you? No. Why not? I'm not into that stuff. So I think that's where it is. It's a lot to do with the will and a lot to do with the emotions. In fact, according to surveys, most religious doubt is emotional in nature. You don't believe because, why? What's wrong with my evidence? I don't care about your evidence. I don't want to. I want to live the way I want to live. So they argue like it's about the data. Then if they lose the argument, it's still, that's not the way I'm voting, that's not the way I'm believing, that's not how I'm spending my money, however you express it, not for them.
Very good, very good. Well, the time has really flown by. Thank you very, very, the time has flown by.
It has.
Thank you very much.
I'm sorry about my ears, folks.
That's all right. That's okay. We love you anyway. Why don't you stand up and give Dr. Habermas a big hand. I really appreciate that.